Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Well, a very busy show ahead of us tonight and a full house. Richard Collins is with us. Niall Hatch will be joining us from wherever he happens to be. And Eanna Launa is in studio also. And we want to start tonight's programme by remembering Moncon McGann, who appeared on this programme many times over the years. Eanna Launa.
Tabron orin galair fui boss Moncon McGann. Vi si eran clar shaw tree neblinta, agus in arira, vi misha erquidges na clarina arina session, sna forisha, agus na forti heart von cheer. Squeeve nor har var vi own, togalor lower squeeve, ega fui na hanim knocker attire and courts, farina, boshtak agus arilla, agus tana lower shin, agin good joe. Ta Moncon slina fearin in ish, slan lat the Moncon.
Gramila Mahagat Eanna. Now, later in the programme, we'll be talking about National Tree Day, which took place last Thursday. And given that we're thinking about trees, it seems like this year was a mast year. Will you explain exactly what that means, Eanna?
This certainly was a mast year. And this is the description we give to a year when all of the fruit and all of the nuts and all of the berries are in abundance in the trees. Now, this, for though, was said to be the case because it was going to be a desperate winter altogether. And holy God was giving us all this wonderful food, so the birds and the bees and so all these wouldn't starve in the winter. But of course, it was a mast year because the springtime was really good. The flowers were there. It was dry. It was warm. The bees, the insects, the pollinators were able to pollinate all the flowers. We had a good summer where the berries could all ripen. And in fact, we had an early summer. We had our blackberries ready in August. I mean, you can't eat them anymore now because St. Michael, who threw the devil out of hell, he fell out of hell into a blackberry bush and was very cross and spat on all the blackberries. So you can't have them after Michaelmas, which is the end of September.
St. Michael threw the devil out of hell.
Yeah, see, Michael the Archangel had a big...
Never heard that.
Oh, sorry. He threw the devil into heaven.
Okay, right, sorry.
St. Michael the Archangel had a big fight with Lucifer and he threw him out of heaven.
Oh, I see.
Not hell. And he fell down onto earth and into a blackberry bush and he was so annoyed he cursed the blackberries. So after Michaelmas Day, one is not supposed to eat them because they have the devil's curse on them. But that would be 30th of September, which is Michaelmas Day. So they're all gone by now anyway, so you wouldn't be getting them to eat. It was really early this year. Loads of blackberries, hips, haws, plums, fruit of all sorts. When you get a great harvest is really what a mast year is. Not the rest of the year, but you get a great harvest, lots of fruit, lots of nuts, and that's what we had this year.
Now, Eanna, I have to ask you, as our botanical correspondent, I must ask you a few questions about this. You talk about mast years, good years and bad years. All the trees produce lots of fruit in one year and then they don't produce anything at all for several years. And I've heard it said that this is a technique they're using to starve the things that are eating their seeds that they want to put down. So a few years of starvation and the things that eat the birds and the mammals and things and the insects that eat their fruit, these all decline because they don't get enough food, and then they have a bonanza year, but there's not so many things around to eat them, so they do very well. Is this true in the first place? But the real question is, how do they synchronize this? Okay, all the trees in this wood do the same thing, but are they synchronized with the ones in Galway and Limerick and everywhere else? How widespread is this communication between trees?
Yeah, but you see, this is not true. It's not that the trees all have a great meeting and decide this is a great way to outwit the enemy. The thing is that when this happens, the things happen as a consequence. So there's loads of food and then there's no food and the pests and things decline. But this is not a decision that was taken by the trees. This is a consequence. The same when you have the lemmings in the Arctic and the birds and the whole connection with that. It's not that they all decide to do it. It's a consequence of what happens. So you can't be putting human plans on top of trees. So the reason why it does all happen all over the place because of the consequences of the good weather in May, the good weather in springtime. And if that allows it to happen, then it'll happen. And normally in the small country, if it's good weather in Dublin and good weather in Cork, it's probably not so bad in Mayo either. And the whole country got that good weather, that good conditions for putting the trees and plants together.
So this theory of cooperating trees talking to each other and forming alliances and all that sort of thing, this is something something that is kind of heretical, is it, in the botanical world?
Whether there's any intention in the tree, as if the tree has a brain and decides this. Now, I think that's for the birds.
Well, that's it's for the birds. I agree, it's
all
for
right.
the birds.
All right, speaking of the birds, let's say hello to Niall Hatch. Niall, where are you joining us from this week?
Hi, Derek. Hi, Anna. Hi, Richard. I'm joining you from Vienna in Austria. I'm here for a couple of days. Yes, I was just the last few days I was in Serbia, in Belgrade, and then up in the north in Zrenjanin and for a BirdLife International workshop and meetings up there. And on my way back, I'm just taking a few days in Vienna. But the show must go on, so I'm putting my time aside to make sure that Mooney Goes Wild goes on the air.
Well, you're just in time because we're going to talk now about Wild Dublin, exploring nature in the city by Aina Ní Leana. Now, should we even do it? She's been all over the place. She's been cheating on us, Richard. She was with Claire Byrne. She was with Pat Kenny. I heard you were fantastic, Aina.
He was asking warmly for you.
Oh, I'm sure he was.
Infidelity. Anyway. No loyalty. That's terrible.
Zero. Anyway, what does it say here? Let me see. It says, Wild Dublin explores the surprising natural wonders of our capital. Ireland's favourite wildlife expert... That's you, Aina. Aina Ní Leana.
I looks didn't at, write it.
Looks at the skies, parks, gardens, wetlands, rivers, canals and coastline to showcase Dublin's biodiversity in all its glory. But this isn't the first time. This is a reissue, isn't it?
That's right, Jess. It came out in 2007. It was one of the first books I wrote after a long hiatus of not writing books. And I dedicated it to my wonderful friend and colleague, Richard Collins, who gave me great help and advice with that first book because I was rather nervous sticking my head above the parapet and being an expert on everything in Dublin, not just the birds, not just the flowers, not just the tree, everything I was going to be the expert on. So I got great help from Richard.
And so who did you dedicate this one to?
Well, I actually dedicated it to Richard again.
He hadn't, no.
He hadn't fallen from favour, so I left him in it.
Okay.
But in the intervening 17 years since it came out in 2007, 18 years now because it's 2025, the amount of change in Dublin has been for the better. You would think everything is getting worse, but it's not in Dublin City. First of all, it has been declared a UNESCO site, and that's one of only two UNESCO sites in Ireland. The other one is down in Killarney, and we do have one up in the north as well, the Giant's Causeway. But this is a UNESCO site of...
What is?
Dublin.
Dublin City,
particularly Dublin Bay. It's Dublin Bay North and South because of all the vast quantities of wading birds that come here and the quality of the feeding for them and the way it is all managed. But on the cover of this particular edition, we have an otter, and otters are top carnivores, and they only occur if everything beneath them is in good order. And of 11 rivers in Dublin City, we have otters on most of them, and this is an indication of the excellent water quality, because if you have oxygen in the water, you have creepy crawlies. If you have creepy crawlies, you have fish, and if you have fish, you have otters. So if you're walking along and you see an otter, you know everything underneath that is in good order. And that's really good, because we don't put sewage into Dublin's rivers any longer. We don't actually have any kind of agriculture or farming or stuff being washed into the Dodder from nitrogen and all of that. So our water quality in Dublin City, amazingly, is very good. There might be litter thrown on the top of it by Aishkeens who throw things in, but the actual water quality in Dublin City is good enough to support otters, kingfishers, things like herons, things that depend upon water quality being good. And that's a great thing. I was delighted with that.
You're quoted as saying, everyone knows if you want directions in Dublin City, you ask a culchi.
Yeah, I'm a culchi.
Yeah, well, why did you say that?
Because Dublin people never know where they're going because they don't ever go past
Excuse
the speed
me, limit. Aina. Ask me.
Well, yes, I know, but it's always the exception that proves the rule. Yeah. But you see, the poor old culchis had to come up and find their way around Dublin, so they had to know. You know, you ask somebody that isn't good at giving directions, and they'll say, well, you go down as far as Ryan's Pub. Now, before you get to the pub, turn left. Now, how do you know where before you get to the pub is when you haven't got to it? I mean, they're desperate instructions.
But is it any worse than the old idea of the country person being asked for directions when they say, I wouldn't start from here?
Well, that's the joke.
And anyway, what's that got to do with the book?
Well, it was because I was the culchi writing about Dublin, the nerve of the culchi to be coming up here and writing a book about Dublin. Why isn't a Dublin person doing it? So I was getting me retaliation in first, as it were.
Oh, yeah, but you're naturalised now, Annie. You've been here for donkey's years. You're from County Louth originally.
I'm always from County Louth. I mean, this business of originally, I'm not from anywhere else in the meanwhile. I'm from County Louth, well, you know the old accent. And I've been living in Dublin since 1967, which is not today or yesterday.
But the year I was born.
But I'm still from County Louth.
All right, okay, Richard.
Anna, loath as I am to praise my old sparring partner, and we've been in many tussles over the years over this and that, it is a beautiful book, I must say. It is a gorgeous thing, and Anthony Wood's photographs, which illustrate it, are superb. He has a great way of photographing something so that it's looking at you. You're kind of having a dialogue with the animal in the picture. Maybe this is an illusion, but I think it's a wonderful thing. But
yeah, and can we just say drawings by David Daly also, Richard?
But something else as well, because some of the pictures weren't in the previous book, and they were generously donated to me by photographers around Dublin. There's a crowd that do pictures all along the River Dodder, and they were vying with each other to send me in lovely pictures of kingfishers, lovely pictures of comma butterflies, things like that that weren't in the previous book. And of course I have a lovely picture of a stoat and a lovely picture of a pine marten that I got from Ruth Hanafy in the west of Ireland, who had these pictures for me. So some of the pictures are not Anthony Wood's, but most of them are, and they are excellent.
I love your turn of phrase, things like graveyards full of life, you know. I love that sort of phrase. And you explode lots of myths. Pinkeen apparently came from an English word, a Middle English word, pink or something like that. I never knew that, and I found that in your book. But the interesting one from the Dublin Bay point of view is the so-called Dublin Bay prawn is not a prawn. Tell us about that.
It's not a prawn and it's not in Dublin Bay. But so why would you spoil a good story with the facts?
Well, you did.
Well, it's the Dublin Bay prawn because apparently in the days the boatmen, the fishermen left Dublin Bay and went off out into the Irish Sea, off Claherhead, off that area there. And 50 metres down is where those nephrops, those particular shellfish live, burrowed in burrows in the sand. And that was what they captured and brought back into Dublin Bay. So they were coming back into Dublin Bay with these yolks. So they were Dublin Bay prawns. I mean, they're called scampi if you're in Italy. They're called Norway lobsters, nephrops. But they are Dublin Bay prawns in Ireland, even though they still have them in the shops. You get them down in Dingle or something. Dublin Bay prawns caught off Donegal because they catch them around the place now.
But and another famous story, which is probably better known than that illusion about the lobsters, is the Bull Island mouse that was exploded by Fergus O'Gorman, and there was a fellow called Lister Jameson, and he maintained that we had a special mouse found nowhere else on the Bull Island, but Fergus O'Gorman came along much later, and James Fairley. Tell us about that.
That fellow Jameson, I mean, it was the time after we had all the evolution happening and all the stories from Darwin and that about how it all happened. And then, of course, Bull Island had only emerged from the sea 200 years ago, and the mice on Dublin Bay were the same colour as the sand. So according to Jameson, these had evolved from the ordinary old grey old house mice that you'd have everywhere else. They must have come onto the island from them. But then in a few generations, they turned sandy brown, and they were especially sandy brown mice. And this was to evade detection from sparrowhawks and kestrels and things out there. Not so much sparrowhawks, but kestrels, which you do get out there. So this was a wonderful example of evolution happening before our very eyes. And of course, to happen in a few generations like that, and it to be an inheritable characteristic, is what you have to have if it's going to be evolution. Almost 100 years later, along comes James Fairley and Fergus O'Gorman, and think this is a very interesting phenomenon altogether. They go out and they trap. They can't find any of these brown mice. They trap on the mainland as well. They find brown mice over there. They find grey mice on the island. And it was just a variable thing that whoever Jemison was doing the trapping only found those on the island. There were houses out there where people lived in at the time. The houses are still there, but there's not so much people living in them any longer. But it was all a fraud. But it was a great story at the time. Evolution before our very eyes on Bull Island was great.
Well, isn't it very dangerous to publish some learned papers on these things? Spartina Anglica, for instance, I read since is not actually on the Bull, but there were papers written about it. Is that true?
Yeah, Spartina Anglica was the seagrass, rice grass, Spartina. And it was considered, because it grows in mud flats, that some misguided people thought if you brought that and planted it on the mud flats, it would trap so much mud, the levels would rise, and you could get dry land upon which to carry out agriculture. But of course, it didn't work out like that. What happened was, of course, it covered the mud flats. It didn't in any way make the land any better for agriculture, and it ruined them for places where we would have wading birds who don't want to be wading in great, just more or less a metre high, this grass. But they actually dug it out of Bull Island. It was on Bull Island, and there was a great campaign. I remember Helen O'Reilly way back in the late 50s, early 60s, when I went to Cumberland. I was in college myself in the 60s, and papers written about it. And they actually removed it from Bull Island. So it had been there, but they were able to get it out. They didn't succeed in getting it out further north in the stands of it up around your neck of the woods. It's still up there, but not on Bull Island. They kept it out, which, but mind you, the building of the causeway caused siltation anyway, and the channels changed, but it didn't affect the birds. We still have our UNESCO site for all the amount of wading birds there, because there isn't great heights of Spartina. It's things like Salicornia, that small little grass, and then mud flats.
Well, now, Anna, I must ask you about Dublin's equivalent of the Aswan Dam, which ruined the wildlife of the Nile, or the Shannon Scheme back in the 20s, which did dreadful things to the Shannon's wildlife. Now, the great big problem in Dublin has been the construction of the M50. Or has it been? Things have difficulty crossing it. They've been run down by all the traffic and so on and so forth. Is this setting up a barrier, isolating the city between the motorway and the sea? Or is this really a problem? Or what can we... Is there a PhD in this for somebody?
Well, yeah, I used the M50 as the boundary when Dublin City, because it was Dublin City Council who sponsored this book originally in 2007, and they wanted me just to do the wildlife of the area of Dublin City Council. But it took me a great deal of effort and difficulty to even get a map of the area of Dublin City Council, all of which is inside the M50. And there's bits of Fingal there as well. There's bits of West Dublin, and there's bits then of Dunleary right down. And I was saying, well, how can I give the wildlife of a nebulous area to the birds all screech to a halt at the boundary of Dublin City Council? Well, I reckoned if I took the M50 as the boundary, very much there on the ground, that would give us, and we have more than 1 million people living inside the M50. We have 45% of the space inside the M50 is green space. It's either parks and graveyards and golf courses and front gardens and back gardens. And it was a very tangible thing. Birds can fly over it, bats can fly over it. And I reckoned it would be a barrier to mammals. And we had no pine martens the first time round in 2007. No red deer, no fallow deer, the fallow deer in the Phoenix Park, who are always there, but none of the other Wicklow ones. But in fact, the M50 doesn't, it's not like the Berlin Wall. It doesn't go right to the sea. So there's a coastal strip coming down along the coast through Sutton down that way. And of course, there's a coastal strip coming up the other side. So wildlife can get into Dublin City on these coastal things. And we reckon from the records of the pine marten there in North County Dublin coming down, and there's been a few records of pine martens being found in Dublin City. Now, they're not hugely validated, so it's perhaps, but if they were there, they'll put manners on the grey squirrels. So if they're in at all, their effects will be felt in the next, you know, 20 years or so. And there is definitely a corridor on both sides. So the M50 isn't right to the wall. So from that point of view, and then, of course, things can fly over it, which they do. We've woodpeckers now in Dublin, which we didn't have in 2007. We've comma butterflies. They weren't there either, only in the very corner of Wexford. So things with wings, the M50 is no bother.
Things with wings, Aina. I love it.
Now, Anna, yes, you mentioned pine marten. Now, that's immediately one thinks of it eliminating the nasty grey squirrels that do so much damage. And of course, though, the red squirrels would be very pleased. But the red squirrels have disappeared from the area inside the M50. And they're not the only ones. We've lost hares. They used to be on the Bull Island. They used to be in the Phoenix Park. And they're not there anymore. So there are winners and losers. You know, the great sewage works in Ringsend has done great. It's moved the Liffey Whiff. I remember the Liffey Whiff very well.
You pull the chain and in a jiffy it all ends up in the Liffey.
Very good. Beautiful. Beautiful, yes. That's it. Well, not quite in a jiffy. Maybe it just lingers for a long time in the...
And getting rid of the paperworks in Sagarth, those Clondalkin paper mills that Smurfit had, that was all discharged into the Camac, and then that came in at Houston Station, and you could tell by the colour of the Liffey what dyes they were using in the print Hamilton factory. That was all stopped as well. So the Liffey Whiff is gone, in fact. Yeah, the red squirrels are gone. They were on the cover of my first hardback edition. And
that's right.
That's the poor old grey squirrel. The poor old red squirrel was on the cover of my first edition. It was in St. Anne's Park, but it's no longer there. The only ones now we can get are outside my arbitrary boundary. We have them in Howth, and we have them in Killiney, but not inside the M50 at the moment. But if we get rid of the greys, then perhaps they will be able to come back. And you know, that's one thing that has happened. So you do get winners and losers. The hares, of course, are the lashings of them at Dublin Airport. But again, that's outside my boundary. And I mean, it's people on Bull Island with dogs, lurchers, letting them off the lead that have spelled the end. When I was doing the first book, they were only actually on the private golf course. You had to trespass to see them, and if you weren't a golfer. But I think they're even gone from there as well. And it's the people with the dogs letting them off their leads. I mean, this is an awful thing to wildlife everywhere. Happens. You go out to Sandymount and you see people letting their dogs off and rushing out and putting up all the feeding birds again too. They have no concept that the dog is not having fun chasing all these birds. These birds only have a certain amount of time to feed between the tides. What are you letting your dog off to run after them for? So wildlife is not dogs. Dogs is not wildlife. Put them on a lead and walk them in the park if you must, but stop interfering with wildlife.
I suppose that's a good point to bring in Niall Hatch now. Niall.
Yes, Dublin is incredibly rich for wildlife, and it's great to see the second edition of your book, Aina. The first edition is one of my favourite books of all time, so I'm delighted the second one is out now. I heartily recommend it. Whenever people are coming from abroad to Ireland and they want to see wildlife, particularly in a convenient way, many different species in a short space of time in a compact area, I say Dublin City is the place to do it. I think a lot of people who aren't familiar with Dublin, particularly with the wildlife of Dublin, are surprised when they learn just how rich it is compared to other parts of Ireland or indeed other parts of Europe. And so I think it's great that your book is focusing on this. And it's been interesting, as you said, to see the changes there, the lack of the red squirrels. Although I would argue that perhaps Killiney Hill is within the M50. I think that, you know, if the M50 goes down to Loughlinstown, I think you draw a line across. I think Killiney Hill might just make it into that boundary. Maybe it's a bit arbitrary. But with the rise of the pine martens and the way that they prey on the grey squirrels, we know that red squirrels are not too far away in Wicklow. So maybe for your third edition, when that comes out, maybe the red squirrel will be on the cover.
Wouldn't that be great? That would be excellent, in fact. So it was in St. Anne's Park and now it's not, so I wasn't going to sort of be stretching the margins out again. I just left it be like that. But I mean, birds coming in, I mean, you know, I got help from yourself to make sure that everything I put in was right. We have the Biological Record Centre down in Waterford where I could check the records for things like dragonflies, things like butterflies. So I have more records of all of those in it, because this facility down in Waterford is available and up and running, and all of their records are publicly available to everybody. So I was able to use that as a source as well too. So I have loads and loads of dragonflies that we didn't have before because the information wasn't there, and they're put in by citizen science who send in photographs and images. There's been a huge interest in Dublin's wildlife, and of course the reason why we have so much is we have different habitats. It's not just all the hard mean streets where you get the feral pigeon standing on Daniel O'Connell's head. I mean, that's a particular habitat where we have that sort of situation. But then we have the waters, we have the canals, we have the rivers, we have ponds where we have things like smooth newt out in Airfield. They have a couple of ponds. People have garden ponds, and that's increasing that kind of habitat. We have the seashore, of course, and we have all of the sand and the mud, and that mud flats and sand dunes, that's another habitat in itself. And then we have the woodlands, places in the Phoenix Park where people have, you know, lots of woodland, and people go out there a lot and look at things. And we have our deer out there, which have been there for generations, the fallow deer. So when you have different habitats, the biodiversity is greatly increased because we have more spaces for it to be in. And that was one of the things I wanted to bring out very much in the book.
Well, that certainly comes across. And I think, as you mentioned, there more and more people are becoming interested in this, and they're submitting their data to places like the National Biodiversity Data Centre, to Barbara Charland's surveys, to also to other citizen science surveys that are happening. And that data is so valuable because it's by mobilising that army of citizen scientists, amateur naturalists who can identify these. It's fantastic. And now, of course, because we all have these supercomputers in our pockets with these built-in high-definition cameras, people can take records of these. They can submit them. They can be verified. And it works really well. And you're mentioning mentioning there earlier about the issue about the major roadways like the M50 and how this can in some ways perhaps be a barrier to certain species, but also for those animals that are unfortunate enough to be killed on those roads, those roadkill records are actually vital. That's actually how we learn often about things like pine martens first coming into an area. It's by finding them dead on the roads. Sad for those individuals, but it shows that the species actually is expanding and doing well.
I think the third edition Nile, which will come out in another 18 years, will have to feature subterranean life, Aina, when the metro is completed in the 2030s, if it ever gets complete. At any rate, the book is called Wild Dublin, Exploring Nature in the City by Aina Nilana, with photographs by Anthony Woods and drawings by David Daly. It was published on the 29th of September and it retails around £24.99 in all good book shops. And it's a cracking read. You enjoyed it at any rate, Richard, didn't you?
I certainly did. It's great to see two surveys of Dublin 15 years or so apart. That's a very interesting thing because you can compare them side by side and see what's happened in the interim. But most of the things are positive, I must say. It's not all doom and gloom. Congratulations, Aina. That's an excellent book.
Are you happy with it, Aina?
I'm delighted with it. I really am. Now I can retire now after this.
Oh, yeah. You're probably making a fortune from it, aren't you?
Look, I lie awake at night, Derek. I didn't know how to spend it.